Welcome to Wise at Work, the podcast exploring the intersection of science, culture, and meaning in the workplace. I'm Corey Smith, CEO of Wisdom Labs, and your host. In this episode, Wisdom Labs' Michael Taft talks to BJ Fogg. BJ Fogg is an innovator, teacher, and behavior scientist who has developed a powerful set of models for understanding human behavior and works in industry helping to design effective solutions for behavior change. He also runs Stanford's prestigious Persuasive Technology Lab, which looks into how computing products from websites to mobile phones can be designed to change people's beliefs and behaviors. And now, BJ Fogg, interviewed by Michael Taft.
BJ, it's great to have you in the studio. Welcome.
Hey, thanks, Mike. Happy to be here.
One of the things that we notice quite often working in the corporate sphere and the workplace is that people really care. And they have big aspirations. Mm-hmm. They have goals. Mm-hmm. Maybe they are the CEO or a new hire in management or C-suite, and they want to change the world, or even as an individual contributor, just have really, you know, aspirations to become something better, to do more, to impact the world in a positive way. And yet there's this gap. There's we see over and over again the gap between the dream and the reality, or the aspiration and the on-the-ground method for making that happen. And so what I've seen from your work is that you actually deeply understand the nuts and bolts of how someone can take a really high, amazingly inspired, ambitious dream and make it a reality. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, as a behavior scientist, you wouldn't expect a behavior scientist to get down to the level of, here's the particulars of how you change your life. And because I have one foot at Stanford in my research lab and my teaching there, and the one foot in industry, and I've done that for 20 years. So I was able to look at human behavior change from both directions, from a systematic, scientific, basic research perspective, and then also eventually working directly with people, helping them change their own behavior.
Yeah.
And the good news is there's a system behind all of this, behind how behavior works. And I think being able to look at it and approach it from those two directions helped me uncover this system in a way that nobody else has. Well, the bad news is that people often, who have these aspirations, try to change and don't succeed, and they blame themselves. That's not good, because it's mostly not their fault. The good news is there are systematic ways, reliable ways to change your behavior, and that you can progress, and it's not as hard as people think.
And so I'm totally curious, what are those ways?
Yeah, well, you always need to start with an aspiration or an outcome. That's where people start. It's naturally where they start. Oh, I want to lose weight, or I want to have more energy, or I want to feel less stressed. Or they may have an outcome. I want to lose 20 pounds and keep it off. That's more outcome, but you start with one or the other. And I've acknowledged that reality. I have 7 steps in behavior design, and the first step is to get clear on the aspiration or the outcome. From there, you can derive a set of behaviors, specific behaviors that will take you to that aspiration or outcome. And the thing that doesn't work is just sticking with the aspiration and just trying to motivate yourself. Like, it's like, oh, I want to be less stressed. I'm going to motivate myself to be less stressed, or I'm going to feel guilty about being stressed. You've got to translate it down or come up with a specific behavior you can do that will have an impact in that direction. And there's ways of doing that. But, you know, the first thing that I'm always watching for in products and programs, or when I teach innovators, or even when I work with individuals through Tiny Habits, it's what is the specific behavior that you're going to design for? And it needs to connect to the aspiration. It needs to be impactful. And I'll give a quick example. A lot of people want to lose weight in this world, and they think that certain kinds of physical activity will lead to weight loss. Well, the fact of the matter is, physical activity is great, but if you want to lose weight and keep it off, it's really about a nutrition change. Okay, so I'm not saying don't exercise, but you can eat like in 10 minutes, you know, 2 hours of exercise. I mean, I don't know what the number is. But my point is, you need to match yourself with a good behavior, a good set of behaviors. And that's really the first active step in succeeding.
And so do you find that there's any formula to matching?
Yes. Let's say that you want to reduce your stress and you come up with 20 different ways to do that. The way to match yourself well is to look for a behavior that has three characteristics. Number one, it actually needs to be effective, would have some impact. If I do X, then my stress will go down. Or if I do Y, at least my stress won't go up. So it has to have impact. Number two, it needs to be a behavior that you can do.
And so you have to have the ability to actually
do it. Yeah, ability. And then it needs to be behavior that you want to do, or at least some part of you wants to do it. Mm. And so it's those three things that characterize a good match with a behavior. And if any one of those three things are missing, then you should look for a different behavior. And you're really looking for the thing with the highest impact, you have the most motivation around, and it's the easiest to do. That would show you what the absolute best match would be for you.
And so this is a fascinating aspect of your work, is that you're often asking people to do the tiniest behavior they can imagine.
Yeah. One of my students and I, David Ngo, and I explored this concept in a lot of depth, and we called it the feather principle. It's so light and seemingly so simple, but has so many applications. And I've always been a fan of simplicity and the simplest thing with the biggest impact. I think that's characterized my work for even before I became a doctoral student. And it just in general in life, it's just like, what's the simplest knife I can have that's the most functional? There's something really for me fun about the simplicity and the impact and optimizing the feather principle, how we would talk about it.
And as I understand the graph you were showing, it's much more likely that you're going to be able to have a continuous ability to do something easy rather than a continuous ability to be motivated to do something hard.
Yeah. And I think that's one way that my research and my insights and my teaching differ from a lot of people, I guess. If you make something really, really easy to do, then you don't have to worry about levels of motivation so much. So things that are really simple to do, your motivation can be relatively low and you'll still do it. Now, motivation can be high too. So you have a wider range. And the fact of the matter is human motivation fluctuates. And we may not have a whole bunch of control over it, whether it's ourselves or other people. But what we can design for is to make something simple or easier to do. And that for me, and you know, looking at my behavior model, the FOG behavior model, as I just looked at the graphical version of that, it shows up very clearly in the visual. And it's like, wow, things that are easy to do have a much higher probability of happening. And that's because when the motivation drops, they can still happen.
Yeah. And so motivation can fluctuate wildly all over the place in the course of a day.
Yeah.
But probably your ability to do something easy isn't going to fluctuate very much at all.
Not as much, right? So I have two concepts. One I call a motivation wave, which is where motivation goes up. Another one is ability window, where we have a sudden burst in ability. The ability dimension is more stable. It just is. Whereas the motivation one, it fluctuates. It fluctuates by the time of day. It may fluctuate by the hour. It may differ whether you've had coffee or not. And the thing is, it's not like we just lose motivation. Motivation seems to be applied in certain domains. So at the beginning of the year, a lot of people are interested in their health, their wellness, improving themselves. Then comes April 15th starts coming up, and at least in the US, that's tax time. So their motivation shifts towards, oh my gosh, I'm going to get my taxes in. And so we have these competing motivations. Mm. So to talk about somebody being motivated or not motivated is a little more sophisticated than that.
It's motivation, time and context dependent.
It's within a domain.
Yeah.
You know, and then within these different domains, it is fluctuating.
So specifically, we're concerned with the workplace and let's say corporate domains. Mm-hmm. And what do you see happening there with this motivation dimension?
I try to help wellness leaders as much as I can, training them, speaking at events. They call me. Anybody in the world can set up a 15-minute appointment with me. And if it's relevant to my expertise, they get on the phone with me and I help them as much as I can. And so even though I'm not inside a company seeing what's happening day to day, I think I have a pretty good sense of what's going on. And the thing that has been surprising to me in the last 4 to 5 years is the concern has shifted away from diabetes and pre-diabetes and obesity and those issues to stress and mental health. And I'm able to go to some of these employer events where it's wellness leaders only, but I'm in the room because I'm teaching a segment and they let me hang out. So it's like leader to leader. And they're just like, man, our people are super stressed. I've just seen that over and over. And that looks like it is not slowing down. I won't name names of a company, but they said, yeah, our workers are super stressed, but we cannot solve the root cause of it. We can't because of management and strategy and how we are. All we can do is, you know, deal with the symptoms and help our employees navigate that.
So does stress affect motivation differently than other things affect motivation? Is it a special problem, a special kind of problem, or does your general formula work for that?
Stress probably is a kind of motivation, right? But there comes a point, and I don't study this, other people have, and it's been long studied, where people just give up, right? They don't have the ability to bounce back. And they just feel like, well, why even try? I'm not going to succeed, or I just don't have the energy right now to try. And at the extreme version, that's learned helplessness. And you've probably read the studies about rats who get shocked and just stop trying.
Seligman and all that.
Yeah. And the thing that I've found is that when people feel successful, even on small things, they start thinking about themselves differently. Like, I'm the person who can do this. I'm the kind of person who can change. I'm the kind of person who now has a way to tackle these problems. And that identity shift then has a ripple effect on other parts of their life. And so the way I see it, the takeaway is help people feel successful.
And even at very, very tiny behavior changes.
Yeah, exactly. Because even though it was a small victory, a small success, it has this disproportionately large impact on how they feel and how they perceive the world and then what they tackle next. The hack or the loophole here is like, yeah, it can be really small as long as they feel like they've succeeded. Now, that second part doesn't always come true, right? People can be very self-critical or they can sabotage. But the interesting thing to me and the thing that I advocate to the people I work with, whether it's wellness leaders or people designing products or services, is to help people feel successful. That's FOG maxim number two. And because that then keeps them going. That then helps create the habit. That then helps them persist in bad times. That then helps them reconceive who they are, shifts their identity. And I mean, I can't say miracle as a scientist, really, but that is just amazing, you know, and it still is, the power of that still impresses me.
And do you have any data about when that shift takes place or how or why, or is it one of those things that just happens?
I don't measure that directly since I don't have a direct way to observe it. So the data I'm talking about is self-report. A high percent of people who attempt to make these small changes, specifically in my Tiny Habits program, then go on and do other behaviors without being asked. A certain percent, between like 10 and 25%, made a big change. Wow, they made a big change just because they started making these small changes. But now I see that week after week. I don't know how to distinguish between the people that have the ripple effects and don't. Almost everybody that self-reports talks about having these additional changes.
And is it also the case that they typically report like a sudden jump in their motivation or belief in what they're doing?
Yes, but let me characterize that. I don't ask them about motivation directly, but I do ask them about how they perceive themselves. So they fill in a sentence like, after doing Tiny Habits for 5 days, I now say I'm the kind of person who... And they can fill in anything they want. They could say, I'm the kind of person who drops the ball. I'm the kind of person who never follows through. But that's not what they say. They say, I'm the kind of person who often, it starts with the word can this, can that. I'm the kind of person who can. Wow. Now, I don't track or even follow up and say, what was the big change or when did this happen? I just don't have a way to measure that as accurately. But what I do know is that it happens and it happens very reliably. And surprisingly, it can happen fast.
Within 5 days, you're saying?
Yeah, Tiny Habits is a 5-day program, and I assess on day 6. So now, let me qualify some of that. This is people who decide to answer the questions. Yeah. There's 4 or 5 questions at the end of the week, and about half the people answer the question, so there's half that don't.
Right.
So you could say, well, there's a bias there. So even if you take, let's say, 80% report ripple effect and you cut that in half or whatever, say the people that completely flailed didn't answer, it's still a really good result.
That's so fascinating and fabulous. I'm instantly going to the other side of the equation. Mm-hmm. However, we in the workplace often have behaviors that need to stop, mm-hmm. maybe behaviors that really need to stop, like addictions or compulsions, but even small behaviors. And I'm curious, does this system that you've developed apply equally well to stopping doing something?
Yeah. No. Short answer is no. I mean, behavior, all types of behavior, whether it's starting, stopping, increasing, decreasing, they all come back. You know, my behavior model describes it. Behavior happens when motivation, ability, and a prompt come together at the same moment. And so notice how I phrase that. Behavior happens when, whether it's a behavior you want to have happen or not want to have happen. So that's part of how I teach people the model and how I teach people to teach it. And so bad behaviors happen when motivation, ability, and a prompt come together at the same moment. And so you can analyze unwanted behaviors from that perspective and the way you get rid of them. And this is easier said than done for many of these types of behaviors is, oh, can we get rid of the prompt? Can we reduce motivation? Can we reduce ability? Or in other words, make it harder to do. And those are ways you would solve for that. There are some behaviors that are really easy to stop, and some behaviors that are hard to stop, and some habits, frankly, that are easy to form, and some habits that are hard to form. So those are all on a spectrum. In my lab right now, what we are looking at are habits that are easy to start and easy to maintain and are also good for you. And I don't have the perfect word for that kind of habit yet, but they exist. They're out there. So when people say, oh, habits are really hard, it's like, no, some habits are really easy. And some of those are not so good for you, and some of those can be good for you. And so what we're trying to do is come up with a huge library of those types of habits and then matching people with those effectively. Mm-hmm. And so it's really a blast doing that kind of work, because not only is it a problem that I think nobody's looked at before, but there's a lot to be discovered from a science perspective, from a theory and conceptual perspective, but the potential impact in the world can be really big.
You know, I just attended your lecture at a huge corporation nearby. It was really fun. And one of the things you said that just really intrigued me was this idea of group change. Instead of just me as an individual deciding I'm going to get better at this or that individual habit, there's this way that we can work together as a family or as a team at work, or maybe even as a whole corporation, to attempt to make these positive behavior changes.
Really, really important stuff. I mean, if you look at social science, you know, so much of that is about the power of social and some about behavior change. But certainly the people around us influence our behavior to a greater extent than we want to admit, for better or for worse. And so it was 2.5 years ago in my Stanford lab where the project was called Change Together. And we spent a year plus looking at how can an individual change his or her behavior leveraging the power of social. So we weren't looking at, you know, corporate level change or even group change. You know, how does an individual change tapping into the power of social, whether that's the household or a class or a church or a company or what have you? And we came up with a model it was a framework. And then within that, we looked at the patterns. And there's not just one pattern, there's different patterns. And one of the distinctions that I think is really helpful, there's two kinds of groups. One I call a destination group, and this is part of the framework. And the other is I call a journey group. A destination group is you involve yourself in a social situation where those people already do the behavior that you want. Mm-hmm. Right? They're already there. So let's say they're really good at mindfulness or meditating. And so you become part of that community and you're surrounded by people who are doing that. A different approach.
And so it rubs off.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you observe, here are the behaviors they do. So you're seeing the behaviors, you're seeing how to, you are probably being prompted by the same sorts of things or being prompted by seeing others doing the behavior. So you have all those things going on, you know. And then, of course, as human beings, we're very motivated by the people around us. Yes. And so you get all those things, motivation, ability, prompt, and specifying the behaviors in a destination group. A journey group, on the other hand, is we're all novices and we're all headed toward this place. And so we're learning together, which is a different thing. So we came up with this framework, and then we looked at instances of this in the real world to map out these patterns. And it turns out you can embed a journey group within a destination group. Mm-hmm. So let's say that six of you go to a silent retreat for 2 weeks where everybody there is, you know, long-term practitioners, right? So the six of you are learning and progressing together, but yet around you, you have people who have mastered it. And that turns out to be one of the patterns, because you have peers, but then you also have role models at the same time.
So you run the behavior design bootcamp that helps people to do this?
Yeah, I run a really special training event. It's a 2-day training event that I call Behavior Design Bootcamp. And it's not a self-help event where people come and say, hey, I want to change my life. It's for innovators. It's for people creating products and programs, people that mostly professionally need to influence the behavior of other people. And basically, I teach my models, the models I've created. You know, that's how to think clearly about behavior, and my methods of how to design effective solutions. And it's 2 days, 12 people. We sit around a big table. It's by a river. And I do as much of the teaching and training outside as I can, because I'm a big believer in nature and learning and teaching in nature. And I love it. It's like my favorite thing. I mean, I teach similar stuff in my classes at Stanford. But those classes at Stanford also have projects, and it's spread out over 10 weeks, whereas the boot camp is like 2 days immersive, and there's no slides. There's no PowerPoint. It's me, a flip pad, and I teach stuff. They learn it. They apply it. We practice it. And that's why I call it boot camp. Boot camp for me is where good people come. We screen and people apply. And so people that are working on projects that will have benefit to the world. And then they come and they meet other people who are kind of amazing people like them. And that's not why they come, but they leave having this great connection to 11 other people. And we've all learned together. And I love it. I mean, it's a blast.
As I've been encountering your material, it occurs to me that it seems to be basically just operant conditioning and behaviorism, correct?
No, not at all.
Oh, good.
Not at all. You know, I have a set of models and a set of methods, and then I have three maxims. Number one, help people do what they already want to do. That's not all encountered in behaviorism, right? Number two, help people feel successful. Number three, simplicity changes behavior. So I do think the principles of operant conditioning are powerful, and they're at play in a lot of things, but that's not how I think about my work at all.
The reason I bring it up is because you're using the term behavior change continuously, which obviously focuses on external behaviors. And as you may know, I do meditation coaching and mindfulness coaching. And a lot of that has to do with internal behavior is probably the wrong term there, but internal.
No, I love this states. Question, at least what I think the question is.
Yeah. So I'm curious how one would apply this to one's own internality.
Oh, absolutely. You know, where you draw the line between what a behavior and isn't a behavior internal could be something that in a graduate seminar we could spend the whole 10 weeks on. But I do think that directed thought is a behavior.
Okay.
I'm not sure like random daydreaming is. Mm-hmm. I think responding internally to a stressor is a behavior, and you can change that. Let's say you're driving along and somebody cuts in front of you, and the car pulled in, they move in, and you stress out over that. So let's say you say, okay, what I'm going to do is every time somebody does that, I'm going to think about one thing of my life that I'm grateful for. I'm just going to process that, use that to be a prompt for gratitude. Bam, you could do that, right? For me, every day is when I turn on the shower, I think of one aspect of my body that I'm grateful for. Nobody can see me doing it. Sometimes actually I will stretch because I'm thinking, oh, I'm appreciative of flexibility. I'm appreciative of this little cut healed. I'm appreciative of, you know, so it is internal. Now, how deep does that go? I don't know. I mean, I don't have the expertise you have in terms of, you know, what are those deeper layers or reaches inside of, but certainly some behaviors are not observable. They happen inside.
And yet the same principles of your work would apply?
I think so. You know, that gets much harder to study. I'm a huge fan of direct measures. As a doctoral student, I set up a psychophysiology lab in the hope that I would be able to run experiments and measure directly what was going on physiologically. And this was in the 90s, mid-90s. And I spent the whole summer setting it up and so on. And, you know, galvanic skin response and heart rate and skin temperature at the time were the three measures. And between those, you could kind of triangulate and figure out, we thought, what was going on. And it turned out that that whole system, oh my gosh, you couldn't make clear inferences from that. So I let that go. However, in today's world, maybe those kinds of measures and others, including some blood tests or what have you, could actually give a direct report of what's going on inside without relying on the self-report.
BJ, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Mike.
Hi, it's Corey, co-founder and CEO of Wisdom Labs. At Wisdom Labs, we're helping companies become wiser workplaces. To create this positive impact in organizations, we cultivate change at the level of the individual, team, and company culture. We see businesses as the biggest lever for positive social change at scale. After all, business still holds the most power and influence in our world. And as individuals, company cultures, and entire stakeholder networks become more wise, we all benefit. To learn more about Wisdom Labs, check out wisdomlabs.com. Thanks for listening.